beans, couch, and potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio, and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be talking about the new movies The Meg, Dog Days, Slender Man, and Black Klansman. I'm also going to be talking about the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring John Carpenter's Someone's Watching Me. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@themovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. Or you can reach out to me on Twitter at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
I'm going to forgo the news segment this week simply because I want to cover some trailers that I missed. A couple weeks ago, I talked about James Gunn and the big debacle with Disney and firing him from Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, last week I talked about MoviePass. So I've kind of let a couple of these trailers drop off, mainly the ones that were released during Comic-Con several weeks ago, and I know I'm behind the times on a couple of these movies because these are trailers that have been out there for a couple weeks, but I kind of want to weigh in on them because a lot of interesting ones have dropped just in the past couple weeks. So I think right now I'm just going to dive right into the trailer park. The first one I want to hit is one that came out at Comic-Con, and that is Fantastic Beasts, The Crime of Grindelwald, which opens on November 16th.
I take it you've heard the rumors. Grindelwald had a vision that he would rise to dominance over the wizarding world.
So you're asking me to help hunt him down?
I can't move against Grindelwald. It has to be you. In your shoes, I'd probably refuse to. It's late. Good evening, Newt.
Oh, come on.
I was sort of lukewarm to Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. There's parts of it I liked. One of the things I really liked about the Fantastic Beasts first movie was it wasn't just about kids at a school. I mean, the wizarding world is so huge and vast that it deserves to be explored beyond Hogwarts. And yeah, you still got Dumbledore in there, and you're going to have some of the recognizable names and characters in there. But I like the fact that it explores the huge wizarding world, and also it explores the wizarding world way predating Harry Potter or even Voldemort, for that matter, as a full-blown wizard. But on the same token, I was sort of disappointed with the first Fantastic Beasts because I just think it played more time setting things up than actually doing a whole movie. And it's sort of like the way the fifth Harry Potter movie was nothing more than a setup for the next several movies that came out. It was this bridge. And I felt that this movie, the original one, took more time getting people acclimated to an adult wizarding world or a grown-up wizarding world that I think they're continuing into a more serious story about something that they're really trying to track down. And you've got a bona fide villain in this one. It looks like it might be quite exciting. So I'm actually looking forward to this one way more than it was sort of my lukewarm response to the first one. The other movie that's coming out in calendar year 2018 that has caught my eye, and this dropped at Comic-Con in Warner Brothers' release of trailers, and that is Aquaman, which opens on December 21st.
Permission to come aboard.
I've been looking for you. Your half-brother, King Orm, is about to declare war upon the surface world. The only way to stop this war is for you to take your rightful place as king.
Trust me, I am no king.
You do your best thinking when you're not thinking at all.
That was the worst pep talk ever.
I gotta admit, I also have a little bit mixed feelings on this one. On one hand, I love the fact that it's taking another step away from that overly oppressive, dark Snyderverse that was started with Man of Steel and continued on. I thought they took a great step away from that with Wonder Woman. I thought Wonder Woman really kind of opened things up. And this one opens up sort of optimism and color into this, so it doesn't look like a partially black and white film. So I think that this is going in the right direction. especially for DC, which has been struggling with trying to make everything so dark and like the Dark Knight movies, and they carried that over with Man of Steel, and I don't think that ever quite worked. This one looks like they're finally breaking free from that, and I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to seeing this as a realized Aquaman movie. We got a taste of him in Justice League, but I think this is giving him a bigger turn, and plus it's not as, you know, muddled and problematic as Justice League is. It looks like it's going after the character of Aquaman. But on the other hand, the trailer's not really grabbing me story-wise. Who knows? It might change in the next couple months. This doesn't open till Christmas. So this might be a big movie, and it might be great. I still don't have a real good sense of a quality film, although I do like where it's going, and this trailer certainly reinforces that. The next trailer I want to hit really quickly is Glass, which opens on January 18th and early release for 2019.
The three of you've convinced yourselves you have extraordinary gifts, like something out of a comic book. David Dunn, the only person to survive that train wreck all those years ago. You think you have superpowers.
It's a feeling. Vision. I have to touch them.
You believe you are a protector.
And yet, it is true.
This is obviously M. Night Shyamalan's follow-up to Split, which is also a follow-up to Unbreakable. I am not a fan of Unbreakable. I went and rewatched Unbreakable after Split came out. It's still not my favorite movie of Shyamalan's work. I think that this could be good, though. I like where it's going. I like the idea of bringing back Bruce Willis and Samuel L. Jackson. This looks like it could be interesting, although it does make me wonder if he's going to be trying sort of the tricks that he's done in the past, the surprise endings and gotcha moments. But the trailer itself looks really quite good. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Shazam, which opens on April 5th.
Bailey Batson, I choose you as champion. Say my name so my powers may flow through you.
But I don't know your name, sir.
Shazam.
Shazam?
This means Billy!
What is happening?
You're the only person I know that knows anything about this Caped Crusader stuff.
What are your superpowers?
Superpowers, dude? I don't even know how to pee in this thing.
This also came out at Comic-Con this past year, and it is another installment of a Warner Brothers superhero film. Like Aquaman, but even more so, this is shaking off that shackles of heavy, depressing, and overly dark series that you got with Man of Steel, Superman versus Batman, and even a bit of Justice League. It's almost going Marvel to the extreme of goofy and silly at times, and that's okay, because I remember reading the old C.C. Beck Captain Marvel, because that was the character's name, Captain Marvel back then, and it's a fun, kind of whimsical, silly series that isn't the same as Superman, and I like the fact that they're playing around in it. And yeah, they've got all the different changes that you've had Shazam go through, but this could be really good. You don't get much of a sense of story, but this looks optimistic and fun. And then finally, the last one is Godzilla King of the Monsters, comes out next summer on May 31st.
The Titans. For thousands of years, these creatures have remained in hiding around the world. And unless all the Titans are found, our planet will perish, and so will we. They are the only guarantee that life will carry on.
I was super excited at the end of Kong Skull Island when they teased the fact that they're going to have this giant kaiju smackdown movie. The only problem is this trailer is just not very good. It feels like they're trying to spin off of the flavor of Godzilla, which was, I thought, a huge misfire. And it looks like there's going to be just a lot of people running around, and then you maybe will see the monsters at some point. The tonal dissonance that you get from this, a lot can happen between now and next summer, and it might end up being a good movie. This could have just been a crappy trailer that was cut. It's just, I was not impressed with this one. Anyways, that is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Dog Days and Slender Man.
It's
welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Now that I've overloaded you on trailers and caught up on some of the trailers that have been really sort of catching my eye for the last couple weeks that I just haven't had time to cover on the show. I mean, it's August. August is always a weird time for movies. The reason August is weird, and I mentioned this back when like Mission Impossible came out. That was the last big bona fide push for the summer movie, sort of the big tentpole summer movie, four quadrant action film. Yeah, we've got The Meg this week, but yeah, The Meg is still, it's still more of an August movie. It's not, no, I don't think anyone's expecting it to be the you know, like Jaws, the big summer blockbuster. But August is always an interesting run of releases because there tend to be a lot of movies released. It is not uncommon to see four or five different titles dropping in a week in August. And that's because I think everyone's trying to unload their movies that really weren't strong enough to compete in the summer box office timeframe. And they try and push them a little farther back, but they don't want to push them so far that it goes into September, because September is a notoriously terrible time for movies. But they also don't want it to roll into award season. The Meg is not going to win any awards. So they've pushed all this stuff into August, and you get a lot of releases, but you don't get big, huge blockbusters. Every now and then you get one, but they usually tend to be like the first release of August. Like, I think there was Guardians of the Galaxy, the original one that came out first weekend of an August. There was also Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was a later August release, and that first live action, full blown mix of live action CGI version that did quite well in August. Suicide Squad did well in August. But in general, August movies aren't big money makers, and especially since the summer got started even earlier this year because Avengers came out in April, it pushes a lot of all the releases forward a bit. So August tends to have a lot of movies, but then there's also a bunch that aren't screened, and I run into that quite a bit. But let's talk about some of these releases. These are ones that I haven't had a chance to see. They didn't screen these locally for me. But let's go ahead and cover them. They're new releases this week. The first one is Dog Days. An interconnected group of people in Los Angeles are brought together by their dogs.
Large pepperoni? No offense, but is your dog pregnant or just super fat?
I called you for pizza, not opinions.
This is why kids don't like old people.
He's lethargic, his appetite is down.
Sam needs to get out there and meet some new dogs.
That'll be $300.
Yesterday.
Her little face looks so angry and happy at the same time.
You keep my dog alive until I get back from the hospital.
I don't know really what to think about this, because when I first saw the posters, I thought it was going to be something more like, what was that puppy show or dog show that was out earlier this year? That kids comedy with talking dogs, like a Beverly Hills Chihuahua kind of movie. That's not what this is. This is basically interconnected stories, and it's you have these sort of ensemble pieces. The best one that and most mainstream type of movie like this that I can remember was when Gary Marshall, rest in peace, directed Valentine's Day, and then later he directed New Year's Eve, which were everybody gets like, you know, a 10-15 minutes worth of story, and they got four or five different interconnected things, and everybody's connected to somebody else, so it's kind of this spider web of stories and romances. And that seems to be what this is. And those can be fun, but it all relies on the characters, if the characters are any good. In particular, as much as I like Gary Marshall as a director throughout most of his career, he's had some really real stinkers out there. But I didn't think the characters in Valentine's Day or New Year's Eve were very good. And that was what made the movie suffer, in my opinion. I didn't think that it was worth seeing, because I really didn't care whether these people find love or not. And this one seems like one of these stories that people are connected by their dogs. It reminds me a little bit of that movie. I interviewed Kate McCucci about it. She was in it, and Sean Astin was in it. It was about their dog and her cat turned into humans. So there's always these whimsical setups with dogs and cats. It looks like it might be cute. A lot of these also depend on how much human interaction it is versus dogs. And I remember the movie The Dog's Purpose. My parents love that movie because they're huge dog fans. And I was sort of lukewarm on that one. And because I loved the dog in the movie, I just couldn't care less about the human story. So that's the real danger in a movie like this, is focusing too much on the human characters when the dogs are the most interesting things on screen. If they just become background and movable props, you don't have as good of a movie. Anyways, I didn't get a chance to see this. It was not screened, so I'm going to have to give Dog Days a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. The next film I want to talk about is Slender Man. In an attempt to prove it doesn't exist, four teenage girls accidentally conjure the mythical and malevolent Slender Man.
Where is my daughter? People don't just disappear.
I do want to see this, and I may try and check it out this weekend. This concept of Slender Man fascinates me. It started out as this internet idea, and there is a guy who created it. There's somebody who you can attribute it to, but it sort of grew a life of its own. It's sort of like any little meme, you know? And you know any of the memes, like the ones of Neil deGrasse Tyson with his hands in the air, or the sarcastic Wonka, or Kermit drinking the cup of Lipton iced tea. There's all these memes that somebody was the first one to kind of put them together, and then the internet took them and ran with it. So this was back when it turned into a great horror idea. I'm a huge fan of horror movies. And there's a difference between horror characters and horror movies and horror icons. Now, obviously, Dracula, Wolfman, Frankenstein, The Mummy, Creature from the Black Lagoon, those are all old-fashioned, old, way 70, 80 years ago characters that are horror icons. Bela Lugosi as Dracula, which is almost 80 years old, is still an incredibly iconic horror character. But there have been other iconic horror characters that, even if they haven't been in, they may have been in a dozen movies, like Pinhead from Hellraiser. He's a great horror icon. And there's only two Hellraiser movies that are any good. All the rest of them are kind of garbage. But he makes a great horror icon. Pennywise the Clown is a great horror icon from It. Not just last year, but the original It from the 1990s with Tim Curry. And Slender Man is a fantastic horror icon and this very creepy and we've seen versions of this in like one of the Conjuring movies. They had the forget what they called it, but a big tall lithe creature in the background. I love the concept of the Slender Man ghost, and it's or whatever it is, a demon. And this movie looks like it could do well. It seems to exist in the realm of J horror. The problem that I have with it is rated PG-13, so it does seem to be going for that Truth or Dare Blumhouse crowd that isn't actually going for authentically scary movies, and it could pull its punches. The trailer looks great, but it could also be neutered quite a bit. I would love to see a bona fide R-rated, truly horrifying Slender Man movie. I don't know if this is going to be that way. But right now, since they didn't screen it for me, I gotta say it gets a preemptive suck.
It sucks.
That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm gonna be talking about Black Klansman and the Meg.
Slender Man. Sympathy for Slender Man.
And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a movie I actually have seen so I can review it. And that is Black Klansman. A black detective in Colorado Springs calls the KKK on a whim and ends up infiltrating the organization with the help of a white detective to play him in face-to-face meetings.
There's never been a black cop in this city. We think you might be the man to open things up around here.
Who am I speaking with?
This is David Duke.
Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. That David Duke?
The KKK is planning an attack.
How do you propose to make this investigation?
We'll establish contact over the phone.
We'll need a white officer to play me when they meet face to face.
So there becomes a combined
Ron Stallworth.
Can you do that?
With the right white man, we can do anything.
This is a Spike Lee joint. I have a hot and cold relationship with Spike Lee. I think he is a wildly talented filmmaker. He has a command of the screen like few others in his generation. And you really see that in his earlier work. I even go back to like School Days. Certainly Do the Right Thing. Absolutely Malcolm X. And you know, his stuff, it's polarizing, yes. And he is a firebrand. And he says things that some people don't like and you're not supposed to like. But you know what? Spike Lee, for all of his bluster and all of his polarizing approaches to things, he is a very talented guy. And in fact, if you look at a movie like Malcolm X, which is my favorite of his films, I know a lot of people say Do the Right Thing's the best one, and Do the Right Thing's okay. I have some issues with that. But Malcolm X is expertly put together. It does run a little bit long, but it's still a fantastic movie. And it's challenging. It's very hard to watch sometimes for especially a white person, because that's the kind of the way Malcolm X was. And if you don't like what Lee's saying in Malcolm X, I don't think that's as much Lee's problem as it is Malcolm X's problem. Malcolm X was not the warmest and fuzziest of the civil rights leaders. After Malcolm X, he's had some decent movies, but especially when he tried to do sort of like just more mainstream regular movies, not something that had a racial element to it. Stuff like he did like Inside Man, which was actually a pretty decent movie, or he did The 25th Hour, oh gosh, about 15 years ago with Edward Norton, the last night before he has to go to jail, report for jail. Recently, he has had a really tough time. I remember he did the movie Miracle at St. Anna, and that thing was awful, and that was meant to be kind of a comeback movie for him. And he did movies like Old Boy, which was a disaster. I actually didn't mind Old Boy, but it did not click with an audience. And I think he didn't quite give it the treatment it needed. But that was a great example of a movie that had nothing to do with race. In fact, it took a lot of the racial issues out of it because it was a Korean movie initially. And it was steeped in Korean culture. And it kind of changed the movie, making it just sort of average white person movie. He did that movie, The Sweet Blood of Jesus, which was this remake of a Haitian vampire story, and it really wasn't very good. Spike Lee's had a rough couple years. But boy, if he doesn't come back swinging with BlacKkKlansman. This is easily his best work since Malcolm X, in my opinion. And the reason it's so good is because, A, it does kind of exist in that true realm. I mean, all the dramatic arc parts, especially as you get in the last act of the film, that's not real. But it is real that this guy who was a black officer in Colorado Springs infiltrated the KKK, ended up talking with David Duke. And he'd get this white guy to show up at face-to-face meetings. It was amazing that this could happen. And originally it was just nobody knew about it. It sort of the case went to bed and it was done. They make it bigger in this movie. But that's okay. It's a Hollywood film. But I mean, the genesis of the idea is right there, which is kind of cool. So it's an incredibly fascinating film. It's also incredibly relevant to today. I mean, he even points it out near the end. There's a little bit of a wrap up. And this isn't a spoiler thing. But he shows stuff like Charlottesville. You know, this white supremacist rally with people with tiki torches and KKK outfits spewing hate-filled slogans. This stuff's back on our streets in a big way now. And that's on the news. And it's answering to that. The thing is with Lee is he's always been a firebrand. He's always been polarizing, but now he's older. And so he's not angry if you don't get him. He used to be kind of, he epitomized that angry black man as a director back in the 90s, and he was labeled that way. But now he's an older guy. Yeah, he still has his opinions, and yeah, he can be brash, but he's kind of like, if you don't get it, you don't get it. The heck with you. This is made for people. And he actually takes a softer hand with this. It's not as in your face and confrontational as, say, Do the Right Thing, or certainly as Malcolm X was. And he does this really interesting thing where he mixes lowbrow and blatant things. Like they have this one Klans member who is the epitome of the walking, talking, stereotype redneck, oh yeah, throwing out racial slurs. And he has him there for that purpose. But then there's other people in the Klan group who are not so obvious and overt. And yes, they're racist, but they're more well-spoken. They handle themselves better. Topher Grace plays David Duke, and he presents himself in a very, as David Duke did back in those days, as a very respectable individual, a businessman and a politician rather than you know, some redneck only wearing overalls and no shirt drinking corn liquor out of a jar, which is kind of what the stereotype that people have for the KKK. And that's kind of genius on Spike Lee's part. He also manages to do things in here that different people are going to interpret differently. And he doesn't, he can get very demonstrative because it's the KKK. Can we agree that you can paint the KKK as the bad guys? I think we should be able to do that nowadays. But there's some comedy in it. There's some very funny moments. And that's, I think, showing Lee's maturity where he's no longer banging you over the head trying to make a racial point. He's just putting it in there. And there's some stuff that you can laugh and there's horrible things in there as well. But it's presented in such a way. And there's a lot of realism here. And this does not represent the entirety of any group of people. You know, the people attending the Stokey Carmichael rally in this movie do not represent all of Black America today or back then, or even all the Black people in Colorado Springs, any more than the KKK members represent all the white people. It's a challenging film, and it's worth seeing, and it's, I think, something that it sends its message home in a much more subtle way than some of Spike's other movies. And it's a fantastic movie. Great performances by like Adam Driver as well. And also by Denzel Washington's son, John David Washington, plays the main character, the title character. It's a great movie and they do great jobs in the performance, and it's relevant, and it's certainly relevant to a lot of stuff that's going on now. So I'm going to have to say Black Klansman totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I don't have a whole lot of time to talk about the Meg. Let's just throw that out there. Jason Statham battles a prehistoric shark five times the size of a great white.
What you people discovered is bigger than we ever thought possible.
How big is that thing?
It was the largest shark that ever existed.
A living fossil.
Thought to have been extinct over 2 million years.
Wrong.
Megalodon. He's kidding, right?
I actually didn't get a chance to see this as well. There's a lot of movies. That happens usually once or twice in August where I'm unable to see the movies. This was due to some scheduling conflicts I had, but still, I'm going to probably check this one out. I'll report back next week. This just looks stupid and fun. You know, August tends to be the release time for shark movies now, and I mean, we can't talk about shark movies without giving a nod to Jaws. I mean, Jaws was the original $100 million blockbuster, and it completely redefined summer releases and tentpole movies. It had all the problems with the shark not working, but that made it even better because it was very suspenseful that way. And it had these sequels and ripoffs, and none of them lived up to it. You know, stuff like Piranha, The Last Shark, or Great White was the movie that they actually had to pull from distribution in the 80s because it was too much like Jaws, or Orca, even Spawn of Slithus, which is sort of like monsters coming from the Venice canals. And none of these would have been made without the original Jaws. This one's directed by John Turteltaub, who did a variety of movies, good and bad, like The Sorcerer's Apprentice. But yeah, it's a big summer blockbuster movie with sharks. And I'm actually not even going to give a rating for this because it was screened. I just wasn't able to make the screening. Anyways, that's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to take a look at Birth of a Nation and the home cinema roundup featuring John Carpenter's Someone's Watching Me. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the final movie review, which is actually an old one. I was inspired to talk about this by Black Klansman. And there's a scene in Black Klansman where David Duke comes to town and holds a meeting with the KKK members, and they sit in an old church or something and watch a screening of Birth of a Nation. But I said to myself, I think it's worth checking out because I had actually never seen it. And while it was still considered a groundbreaking piece of cinema, it certainly had the burden of being a movie about the Klan. And originally titled The Klansman. My parents, not a big fan of the Klan. And they wouldn't have allowed it. They didn't want to see a movie that glorified the KKK. It's very racially offensive in a lot of ways. So I said, no, I'm going to sit down. I'm going to watch Birth of a Nation, and I weigh in on it because it's such a famous movie. And so here's my chance to actually look at it and see how it affects the racial views of today and how it can be related to what's going on today. Also, things that are happening in cinema and what's offensive now versus what was offensive then and what's not offensive in 1915, which is horribly offensive now. D.W. Griffith's groundbreaking film looks at the effects of the Civil War on the American South and how the Ku Klux Klan surged as a result. Now, there's no trailer for this one because it's a silent film. There's a couple ways to look at this. You can look at this as a piece of cinema history and how groundbreaking it really was. And that's one of the reasons why it's lived for so long. Yes, the glorification of the KKK, and if you're in the KKK or people who have a familiarity with the KKK are going to be a little more sympathetic towards it. And it does kind of have that, it is steeped with that Southern pride feel to it. But it's not gone with the wind. Part of the reason it has lived is because of how groundbreaking it was, completely from a cinematic point of view. Back in the teens, a lot of these silent films were just, they'd set a camera up and they'd have a stage, almost like a little black box theater, and it almost looks like a shoebox in a lot of these shots, and they'd do a minute or two or a reel of film of action happening in front of it, and then they'd move it to a different location. What's amazing about this from a cinematic perspective is the use of cutaways and close-ups and action that continues. There's whole action sequences. I mean, it's horrifying action sequences because it's got the Klan running around, but these action sequences of them riding horses and going through and chasing somebody, and there's certainly a real sophistication to telling the story on screen. And it's one of the first movies to do it. And it's also one of those first big blockbusters. I talked about how Jaws was the first summer blockbuster. This was one of the first huge movies. Now, it was kind of four-walled in a lot of places where it was released. So I'd read somewhere that, you know, an average ticket for some of the releases of A Birth of a Nation were in the modern day equivalent of like $50 prices. So sort of like those super ticket movies that they have nowadays, or like when Kevin Smith four-walled his movie Red State and did it basically to do an evening of him talking. But there's no doubt about it that it's an amazing movie from how it was made. So that said, let's put that aside. Now let's talk about the story of the film. Now, the first half of the film, before the intermission, is essentially a Southern reaction to the Civil War, and it's told in a lot of ways with the South as the protagonist, and as the, not just the characters, but the South as a whole, and then the Confederacy. And yeah, you have the blackface in there, and yeah, you've got the black characters portrayed and set up, but pretty much it's about the Civil War. It's about the people going off to fight, and it's about Lincoln before he gets assassinated. And it does show Lincoln in a sympathetic light because he was seen by some in the South, not all of them, obviously, but some in the South as at least wanting to reunify things. And now that the war was over, build a bridge. After the assassination of Lincoln, and we kind of go into Reconstruction, and the same thing happens in Gone with the Wind. There's a huge break in the middle of it where you go into Reconstruction and you've got the carpetbaggers who are even bigger criminals than the Union soldiers in a lot of ways in Gone with the Wind. And you get this in the same way with Birth of a Nation. Carpetbaggers were not looked upon well. Nor were scalawags, by the way. And then it becomes a Reconstruction movie. And in the process of this Reconstruction movie, it also becomes a Ku Klux Klan movie. And that's when it goes off the rails. And I don't think if you tried today, you could not make a more over-the-top, ridiculous, almost comically offensive movie. You've got scenes where the black people are, you know, former slaves, the free men are taking over the state houses and the state legislature, and they're drinking whiskey on the representative floor, and they've got their feet up and they're picking their toes. I mean, it's really, really, really demonstrative. And what's odd about the movie is, you know, you have all this stuff where they have the blackface in there. You have white people playing black people with like basically shoe polish on. And then you have real black people and they're playing roles. And I don't understand why they made a difference in some of these, but they did. And it's really hard to watch because, boy, it, again, oh, wow, just glorifies the KKK. And I can see where there was a resurgence of the KKK in 1915 as a result of this movie. I mean, it really glorified them. And I think by the time Gone with the Wind came out, it usurped Birth of a Nation as a little bit more of a politically correct at the time glorification of the South. And I think that's part of the reason why it's so beloved, because it could replace the movie that even by 1939 was starting to get offensive. So it's really hard to watch. I'd be troubled to actually give a grade to this movie, because on some hands it's a brilliant film. But its subject matter is so heinous and so awful and so normalized in the movie that it can make you almost feel physically ill. I don't think it should ever be put away. I don't think it should ever be disappeared. I don't think it should ever be banned, because this was a wildly popular movie 100 years ago. And it shows that we were at a very different place 100 years ago than we are now. And are there still lingering problems? Yes, absolutely. We should move past this nonsense and garbage, but we shouldn't hide it away. We should be aware that it happened, because we don't want it to repeat itself. And I mentioned earlier when I was referencing Black Klansmen, when you have stuff like Charlottesville happening, where you have Nazis and KKK members marching openly in the streets, and then when they're faced with opposition, that it turns violent, I think that this is a good movie that we need to remember existed. And, you know, you can go find footage of the KKK marching in Washington. That's not a good thing. This is a movie that I think should be watched. The subject matter is horrifying, but it's something that should not be forgotten for that very reason. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week, I want to spotlight another old John Carpenter movie that Shout Factory has brought to Blu-ray, and this is really significant. As much as I loved In the Mouth of Madness, which came out a couple weeks ago on Blu-ray, and as much as I love stuff like They Live and Prince of Darkness, which are his other movies, someone who's watching me has been called the Lost Carpenter film, even though it's been available on DVD for a while. It was a movie that aired in 1978, right around the time Halloween came out. And John Carpenter was still trying to make a name for himself as a director, and he was just taking like a gun-for-hire type job as a TV movie director. And this is what we ended up with. Lauren Hutton stars as a television director who moves to L.A. only to be stalked by a violent Peeping Tom.
NBC Big Event continues following these messages.
Wednesday.
I'll find you. I don't give up.
I want to go to the police.
I already did that.
This time it's my turn.
Lauren Hutton, David Burney, and Adrian Barbeau. She has everything to live for, but someone wants her dead. Someone's watching me. Right after Dick Clark Wednesday on NBC.
That promo is... That's the best I could find for a trailer. It was the NBC promo for the movie. And I remember watching movies like this, where it was the big event movie, and they aired once, and you never saw them again. But aside from Elvis, which was another TV movie he made a couple years later, this was the only John Carpenter movie I've never seen. And I gotta say, it's actually really good. You know, some of the earlier stuff, like Dark Star, is a really chore to get through. But this is a well-conceived, excellent little thriller. And it doesn't feel its age like some of the movies in the 70s do, especially the TV movies. TV movies were a lower breed of entertainment back then. I mean, if you compare this to, say, Steven Spielberg's Duel, which was a TV movie early in his career, this is way better than Duel. It's a great, paranoid Peeping Tom movie, and Lauren Hutton's good in it. It's got a good cast. Adrian Barbeau's in it. I was impressed with this movie, and it's up there with one of the more watchable and rewatchable Carpenter movies, especially for one that's not, you know, supernatural. And, you know, Prince of Darkness I love, and They Live I love, and The Thing I love. This is a little bit more visceral, down-to-earth horror. Very well-constructed, very well-paced, and it looks great on Blu-ray. They did a great redo with the transfer. So definitely worth checking out. If you've never seen it and you want to get your Carpenter fix, this is the time to do it. Someone's Watching Me totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Other movies that are out this week on DVD and Blu-ray include Life of the Party, Breaking In, and Predator in a new 4K restoration. And that is it. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about Alpha and Mile 22. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.